Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today my guest is author and journalist Bob Herbert. Bob joined the New York Times as an op-ed columnist in June 1993. He writes about politics, urban affairs, and social trends in a twice-weekly must-read column. His career began in 1970 as a reporter, then Night City editor in 1973 at the Star Ledger in Newark, New Jersey. Mr. Herbert earned a Bachelor of Science degree in journalism from the State University of New York, Empire State College. He's taught journalism at Brooklyn College and the notable Columbia University School of Journalism. He's won numerous awards, including the Meyer Burger Award for coverage of New York City, the American Society of Newspaper Editors Award for distinguished newspaper writing, and the David Nyan Prize from the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University for excellence in political reporting. I very much welcome you to our program, Bob.
It's wonderful being here, Helen. Thank you so much.
Well, we're on the cusp of change now. This program will not be aired for several weeks, but just to put the record straight, I'm interviewing you on the 14th of January, New York time, which is the 15th of January in Australia, where we're taping. And by the time the program airs, Obama will have been inaugurated as the new president. Bob, just tell us how you feel about that.
Well, I'm still a little stunned at the turn of events. I think that it's pretty incredible that he came from essentially politically out of nowhere just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And has had such a rapid rise. I mean, I remember going out to Chicago a few years back when he was running for the Senate seat from Illinois. And I had gotten a tip from a very good friend of mine who had been a producer at ABC News and who was very savvy about politics. And she said, Bob, you need to go out to Illinois and take a look at this fellow named Barack Obama. He's an African-American, and he's running for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, and he's going to win. And I said to my friend, listen, if this was anyone else talking to me right now, I'd hang up the phone because this sounds ludicrous to me. You're going to have a black guy running for the Senate in Illinois named Barack Obama. I've never heard of him, and you're telling me he's going to win. And she said, yes, he's a new kind of politician, and I really think that it'd be worth your while to go out and take a look at him. And, of course, she was right. I mean, I went to Chicago, and I followed him around for a little bit, and I wrote a column that was very kind to him. And I really did think that he stood for a new kind of politics. But I must tell you, it never occurred to me that only a few years later he'd be elected president of the United States.
Mm. It's a revolution, isn't it, Bob?
Well, that kind of remains to be seen. It has some of the hallmarks of a revolution. Obama is a very interesting and complex fellow. And as I've been looking at him and reasonably closely for a while now, he's above all a politician. He's very smart. He's very savvy. He has a sophisticated grasp of the issues. And I like most of his positions. But he is above all a politician. And the United States is in a very tough situation right now, dire economic straits. And, of course, we've still got the wars going in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I would like to see someone who is very progressive in their policies, not just their stated politics. And, you know, it remains to be seen just how progressive Obama is. If he is as progressive as I'd like, then you would see a revolution. My guess is that he'll fall somewhat short of that, but I can't imagine that he'd be anything other than a welcome change from the Bush years.
Yes, I also use that term revolutionary cautiously, but in terms of the black population in America and their, you know, terrible history, it's just been an outstanding thing for them, hasn't it? Wouldn't you agree?
It's been amazing. I can't tell you because I was going all over the country covering the campaign. And, of course, as he began to close in on the nomination, for starters, and then after he won the nomination and it began to look like he had a good shot at actually winning the presidency, I can't tell you how many tears I saw when I would go into African-American communities and I would interview people. And, you know, at times they would just break down and cry. I remember one time here in New York, I wasn't working. I was at home on the west side of Manhattan, and I had ordered in, as we so often do in New York. So a fella came to deliver the meal that I'd ordered. And, you know, I'd seen him several times, so we knew each other, but he was a very quiet person. He never said more than thank you. You know, you'd give him a little tip and he'd say thank you and leave. So this was the night that Obama actually secured the nomination. And when he came to the door, then this delivery man is African-American, and when he came to the door, he's probably, I would say, mid to late 50s. He came to the door, and I paid him and gave him a tip, and I said thank you, and he said thank you, but he paused, and he looked up at me, and then he said, Mr. Obama won, didn't he? And I said, yes, he did. And then there was another pause, and he said, for sure? And I said, yeah, he won the nomination. And I must tell you, this fella, just the biggest grin spread across his face. His face had always been impassive, light, but never much of an expression.
Yeah.
And just the biggest grin. And he just turned and he walked down the hall.
Yes, yes.
It's been that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's going to give self-esteem to the African-Americans that they've never really felt before. I mean, you can feel it in those people in Canada, but not in the United States because of the history of slavery and the like. But I think this is going to elevate them into a new sphere of being, don't you?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I'm seeing it already, you know, and I see it more in casual conversations when I'm not really interviewing people, where you get kind of a different take on things. It's much more political when you're doing interviews. But just in your ordinary conversations with sometimes people you know and sometimes people you don't know, I've noticed that among blacks, there is just almost palpable feeling of holding your head just a little higher, a little more power, if you will, in a person's step, you know, moving forward, a feeling of, yes, in fact, we've arrived. We've known all along, you know, that you deserve equality in this society, that discrimination is wrong, that there is no reason to look down on yourself because of the way some people treat you and that sort of thing. It's all a given, all understood. Nevertheless, with the success of Obama, there's just been this palpable pride and a sense of a feeling of uplift. I mean, I think it's very real. I think it's difficult to describe, but I am absolutely certain that it's real.
Yeah, well, I loved it when he arrived at his hotel in Washington to begin his pre-inauguration affairs and put his children in school. And these wonderful women from D.C., African-Americans, all dressed up in their best and furs and everything to greet him. Of course, he didn't stop and talk to them. But just to be there, they said, was an historic occasion. It just warms the cockles of my heart, I think.
I think it's a wonderful thing. You know, one of the things that's happened, and I've watched this in the course of my lifetime, and I'm actually going to give George W. Bush a little bit of credit here, believe it or not. I've always been a big believer in things becoming normal. Like you have to make things happen, and then after it happens over a period of time, people just accept it as normal, mm-hmm. and they don't even much think about it anymore. And that's one of the reasons why I thought as a youngster that integration was so important in the public schools and everywhere else. But anyway, when I was a young kid, it was very unusual to see black people at all on television. There were no black reporters, certainly no black anchors on the newscast. There were hardly any blacks who had television programs. Nat Cole had a show, and it was considered an extreme big deal that he was a black guy who had a television program. And then, of course, after a while, you saw more and more blacks on television. There were reporters, and, you know, there were even anchors. And then after a while, it became, you just took it for granted that you would see blacks on television. When I was at the Star-Ledger back in the early 70s, there were very few black elected officials in high public office. There were some, but not many. And I remember the first black person to become elected mayor of North New Jersey, his name was Kenneth Gibson. And that was considered like such a big deal. I mean, just enormous screaming headlines in the New Jersey papers that this fellow had been elected mayor. But what has happened over the years is you've gotten more and more people into elective office. And then you have the Bush administration, which I think was so harmful in so many ways. Nevertheless, when he appointed black people to high positions in his cabinet, you know, so whether it's Condi Rice or Colin Powell, for example, in the position of Secretary of State, after a while, Americans got used to the idea that the Secretary of State could be an African American, so that at some point it kicks in, it's no longer a big deal.
Yeah.
And now, of course, Obama has reached that final hurdle in terms of politics. So you'll have an African American who's president of the United States, and it is just so important, even though it takes a long time and it's a struggle, but it's just so important for this stuff to become normal. And then after a while, you don't have to think about this particular hurdle anymore. And I just think that that's fascinating. My personal opinion, of course, is that it's fantastic. I'm sorry that some of this stuff takes so long to unfold. Nevertheless, it gives me hope that we're still moving in the right direction.
Yeah, that there's a light on the hill. I'm interviewing Bob Herbert, who writes twice weekly column in the New York Times. Bob, do you know about Obama's background in politics in Illinois, where he lived in Hyde Park and worked with the black community there very closely and was a community
organizer?
Yeah.
I know a little bit about it. I never covered him there. But one of the things that I think is interesting, because we know that Chicago politics can be treacherous.
Yes.
He remained, to some degree, aloof from the nuts and bolts of Chicago politics. It was almost as if he understood that if you got too close to this flame, you could get singed, you know. Nevertheless, he needed alliances. He's always been very good at getting mentors, powerful figures who sort of shepherd him along. But he's also been very lucky in terms of his opponents. He in his Senate race, there were a couple of people who were favored to get the Democratic nomination who self-destructed because of personal problems, the ugly divorces and that sort of thing. I guess there was one in terms of the Democratic opponent and then also one in terms of the Republican that was expected to be favored. And then, of course, they ended up with Alan Keyes, a black candidate who nobody thought had a really serious chance. I mean, the Republicans got themselves into a position where they couldn't field a competitive candidate against Obama. And so that's quite a bit of a stroke of luck. Then he goes on to win that race. But, I mean, part of his political genius is that, you know, he knows how to take advantage of all these opportunities. So it's one thing to be handed a stroke of luck. It's quite another, you know, to cash in on it. I have always thought that one of the most amazing things about Obama, and I'm still somewhat admiringly baffled by this, is I can understand political genius. I can understand charisma. I understand someone who has a great gift for public speaking, and Obama has all of the above. But one of the things that baffles me is where he got the ability to mount this enormous national campaign for president, put it together, manage it so well, this astonishing fundraising apparatus. I mean, he was up against Hillary Clinton with all of the resources that the Clintons were able to draw upon, and he just mastered it. And it seems he seems to have mastered that in terms of political years in such a short period of time. And to me, that's almost the most astonishing aspect of this whole Obama phenomenon, that he was able to pull that off. It was really a staggering achievement.
Yes, well, then we need to move on and look at his appointees, which is quite a fascinating process, I have to say. Least of which is the appointment of Hillary Clinton herself. And she had her Senate hearing yesterday and apparently came out quite well. But I always feel kind of uncomfortable watching Hillary, reading what she says, on account of I'm not really sure if I trust her. Can you give us a sort of feeling of where you stand on the Hillary appointment, who she is, and what you think she can achieve in this extraordinarily dangerous world today, Bob Herbert?
Yeah, and that is complicated. And I guess the jury's still out on my feelings as I watch the Hillary process unfold, where first there were rumors that she was being considered for Secretary of State and then blah, blah, blah. It struck me that this was Obama, the politician, at work.
Yep.
That it was a brilliant stroke for him in terms of being president and running an administration, having someone who's very smart, very talented, knowledgeable about foreign affairs, bringing that person into the cabinet in a position that has to work so closely with the president. So she's not there in the Senate hurling thunderbolts at the administration. You know, it also shores him up. There were a lot of women in this country who were very disappointed that she didn't get the nomination. There were women who felt that it was a woman's time to be president in the United States. Most of Hillary's supporters came around and voted for Obama, but there was still a sense of disappointment there. And Secretary of State is a heck of a consolation prize. I mean, you know, it's the premier post in the cabinet. And when you think about Hillary, I remember a lot of people were wondering why would Hillary want it. And when you think about it, if she's not going to be president, the idea of a family where the husband was president of the United States and where the wife was Secretary of State, no historian is going to be able to ignore that. So that's a pretty profound historic statement, which is the main reason why I think Hillary actually wanted it. Now, I don't really know what to expect from her.
I don't either.
Because Obama has such strong feelings about foreign policy himself. So, and we have no idea how they're going to work together or whether there would, in fact, be clashes that that would be harmful in terms of U.S. foreign policy. I just don't know. I mean, Obama, he really got his start on the national stage by being opposed to the Iraq war. He was saying, you know, I'm not opposed to all wars, but I'm opposed to stupid wars. And he seemed pretty strongly in his public statements to be in opposition to our involvement in Iraq. Hillary, of course, had been in favor of the war. Well, now that Obama's been elected president, you know, he's moving slowly in terms of a withdrawal from Iraq, which I actually expected would be the case. But he's also talking about substantially beefing up our involvement in Afghanistan, which at this point I'm opposed to. I was in favor of the United States going into Afghanistan after September 11th, but that's 7 years ago, more than 7 years ago. And I think now, he could be getting himself into a quagmire.
Oh, yeah.
So we don't really have a sense of, on these matters of warfare, for example, of where Obama is really,
it's
really coming from.
Very strange. And I actually wasn't in favor of America bombing Afghanistan either. I mean, the fact that Osama was there didn't necessarily tie in with the fact that I think of the terrorists who hit the World Trade Towers, four were from Saudi Arabia and one from Egypt or something like that. They actually didn't come from Afghanistan. They were recruited
by Osama. It was true that the Taliban had allowed them pretty openly to have these terrorist training grounds, Al-Qaeda,
In
Afghanistan. And
yeah.
Taliban were some, there were some, that was an evil group itself. I did not have a problem with the United States going into Afghanistan in the aftermath of September 11th. But to me, the goal then would be to rout the Taliban and destroy Al-Qaeda if you could and track down Osama bin Laden. And, of course, to be diverted from that goal and to go in and conduct this in what I consider to be an insane war in Iraq was just ridiculous. Well, now 7 years have passed. We've still got, I guess, about 30,000 U.S. troops and a lot of foreign troops in Afghanistan. And to now come in and double the U.S. presence without a clearly stated mission, where Obama is believed to be in Pakistan in any event, I don't see how this is a good move for the United States at this time.
Yeah, do you have, Bob Herbert, any notion of why, do you think Obama's placating the military and the Pentagon and the hawks by saying that he'll persist in Afghanistan, when I'm now reading from your wonderful article, The Afghan Quagmire, published on January the 6th, where you quote Michael Gordon from The Times, when he said, Afghanistan presents a unique set of problems, a rural-based insurgency, an enemy sanctuary in neighboring Pakistan, the chronic weakness of the Afghan government, a thriving narcotics trade, poorly developed infrastructure, and forbidding terrain. I mean, surely Obama's aware of this.
You know, I would assume. I mean, I asked the question, what's the upside for the United States? If you're looking in a very selfish way, what's the upside for the U.S. to doubling our troop presence in Afghanistan? And I do not find an answer to that. And, you know, I'll tell you what it reminds me of. It's not an exact parallel by any means, but it very much reminds me of when John F. Kennedy took over as president in January 1961.
Uh-huh.
And in his short tenure as president, of course, we beefed up what they called advisors in Vietnam. You know, we was just moving a little bit ahead in Vietnam, increasing our presence in Vietnam. And, you know, we didn't learn our lesson from the French, who had been routed in Indochina.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks now like we haven't learned our lesson from what happened to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. You know, you send your troops into these faraway places where they have this unforgiving terrain, as you're pointing out. They're going to be vulnerable to guerrilla warfare, because that's the kind of...
Yep.
A warfare that will be conducted against them. We're not good at that. We're good at bombing things and destroying conventional forces. And our economy is in the tank. I mean, we can't pay for the wars the forces we have in Iraq and Afghanistan as it is right now. You know, so the idea of increasing anything is insane. We don't have the money for it.
Yeah.
And it just seems like a bad idea.
And especially the history that England was routed in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union was, and in fact America, by fighting the Soviet Union, helped to initiate the Taliban.
That's exactly right.
Al Qaeda in Afghanistan, so and armed them. So
that's a story that's not sufficiently told.
Why don't you write a column on that? I think that'd be a good one.
Well, before the September 11th attacks, I was writing about the Taliban because one of the things that has always outraged me was, you know, the treatment of women by the Taliban in Afghanistan. But, you know, the role the United States played in the emergence of the Taliban is not well told.
Let alone the treatment of women in Saudi Arabia, huh?
Yeah, that's something we don't talk about at all,
that's
right?
That's just ghastly.
those are our buddies. Right?
Oh,
why would we want
God.
To embarrass our buddies?
A woman, commits adultery, they bury her up to her head and then stone her head, you know, with stones and kill her. So they're our best enemies. That's because they've got the oil. Just one more question about Hillary, Bob Herbert. I'm worried about Iran. I've been to Iran. My brother was a diplomat in Iran. It's a very beautiful country. It's a country of poets. They're Persians. I mean, Ahmadinejad is kind of a bit of a crazy guy. But the head of the clergy there, and I can't remember his name, is really the president. And obviously they're enriching uranium because they say they want nuclear power, yet they're sitting on a huge reservoir of oil. But then Israel's got huge numbers of nuclear weapons, maybe the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world. This has to be really diplomatically finessed. And do you think that, I know Obama's talked about negotiating and talking to Iran, which is obviously the only way to go, but do you think Hillary has the capability, the sensitivity, the diplomatic skills, after she said she would annihilate Iran in the election campaign?
That was one of the low points of the campaign.
Fairly low.
But one of a number of low points.
Yeah. What's your take on that?
Again, we have to look to Obama. I couldn't agree more with you that this is going to require, you know, the most sophisticated, most delicate diplomatic approach one can imagine. Obama gave the signal that that's what he favors. And it was one of the points of contention between him and Hillary during the campaign. I do believe that Hillary will follow the administration line when it comes to Iran. I don't have any doubt about that. What we don't know is what the administration line is going to be.
Mm.
Hillary will be influential in the development of our approach to Iran, but so will Joe Biden. So will others, but we don't really know that much about Obama's brain trust or his thinking itself. I don't think that you can really go by what was said in the campaign.
No.
If Obama wants to move in a sophisticated diplomatic way in his dealings with Iran, which I agree with you is what's required, I'm not under the illusion that any of that would be easy, but I think that's what's required, then I think that if Hillary got her marching orders, she would carry that out. And I believe that she's confident enough and smart enough to do it effectively.
Yeah.
But it all depends on what the policy of the administration is to start with. And, this move into Afghanistan is so worrisome.
Mm.
I mean, these presidents get in there. And they like to flex their military muscles. I mean, I guess it's a heady thing. You know, you're a commander-in-chief of the most powerful military the world has ever known. And I've seen one president after another just do nonsensical stuff when it comes to war. The hope had been that Obama would be different, that he really would represent change in these matters. So I still have that hope. I'm hoping that this Afghanistan thing is a bit of an aberration, that when he looks at it, he'll find out that that may not be the road to follow, and that we'll start thinking in terms of peace rather than endless,
killing,
not just destructive, but self-destructive wars.
Yes. I'm interviewing Bob Herbert, a journalist from the New York Times, and actually we're talking at a time when Gaza is being attacked and over 1,000 people have been killed. I had nightmares last night about that, Bob, I have to say. I just don't know where it's going to lead, and I know it's a subject that not many people like to talk about, but I do think it has to be discussed. Do you?
Well, I hate to keep giving the same answer, but this is the situation again. We had the Bush administration that let just these important years go by without addressing that situation and without trying to come to some reasonable solution or at least some sense of progress. Now we have a new administration. What is Obama's approach to that going to be? Again, you cannot tell from the campaign, because the campaign politics in this country are just skewed by the electorate. What we want to see is how he's going to move forward, and this, of course, is going to fall under Hillary's job category as well, how he's going to address the whole idea of Israel and Palestinian.
Mm.
At the moment, I don't have a clue. I really don't. I wish that I did.
Yes, that's true. So let's move on then. You've written an article recently about the debt in America. And as we move into that, knowing that the United States is spending close to $1 trillion a year if all the black accounts and the intelligence areas are counted, and the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, close to $1 trillion a year on the Pentagon and basically killing, I would say, as a sort of peace operative. And then you move into the debt that Bush has incurred, and I think you're up to $10 trillion now in foreign debt, and then the $700 billion that Paulson has promised to the banks and the people who did the awful stuff in the economy, and then another, you know, $600 billion or so that Obama's promised to ramp up the economy. And
I think that's up to $800 billion now.
So you were pretty pessimistic when you wrote your article about this, Bob. And where on earth that's titled "Where the Money Is," January 23rd.
You know,
my God! And you know, we're in Australia here, and we're suffering too, like hell. And you've got now up to 21 million people who are out of jobs, and your safety net is nearly as good as ours in Australia. Nor do you have free health care.
Right.
I mean, will Obama have the guts that FDR had to start looking after Americans and stop favoring those blasted rich people who, you know, get their tax cuts with impunity? I mean, will he have the guts to stand up and do the right thing as FDR did?
You know, I grew up in the suburbs in New Jersey, a wonderful town called Montclair, about 12 miles outside of New York. Lovely place for kids to grow up. This was back in the 1950s and 60s. And I have a sister who is 4 years younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And our parents were not really strict. So if my sister and I were misbehaving, you know, we didn't get spankings and my father wouldn't yell at us or whatever. But if we were getting out of line, I remember my father would give us a look. He'd look at us and we'd stop and we'd stare back at him. And then he would say, "Have you lost your mind?" You know, and I almost feel that way about this country. I look at the stuff that's going on, and I wonder if we haven't collectively lost our minds. Quick example. Bush goes into Afghanistan and into Iraq after September 11th, and at the same time, he cuts taxes. So we have like these two wars. So he's cutting taxes in wartime, which is just insane. Now Obama is going to beef up our presence in Afghanistan, actually double it, it appears. And he's cutting taxes. He's giving us middle-class tax cuts now, when we have the kinds of deficits and national debt that you were just talking about. I mean, it seems like insanity to me. And here's what I really worry about. Even if Obama is serious about trying to address the struggles of middle-class people who are, which he talks about a lot, who are losing jobs and who have lost their 401ks in the stock market crash, and who in many cases don't have health care and that sort of thing. And then you go beyond that to working people. The auto industry, as we know, is in a dreadful situation. And then poor people who are almost forgotten about, they're hardly ever even talked about in the United States anymore. If he's serious about addressing the needs of these scores of millions of people, here's what's going to happen. We've got these deficits you're talking about. We've got the $350 billion that we've already given, most of it to the banks and the brokerage houses. He's asking for the other half of this so-called TARP money, another $350 billion. There's a fight over that.
What does TARP stand for? What, Bob?
Troubled Asset Relief Program. The reason it's called that is because initially Treasury Secretary Paulson and Bush, although it was really Paulson's idea, was that they were going to buy these toxic mortgage-related securities from the banks. You know, $700 billion is going to spend, take these toxic securities off the hands of the banks. And the idea was that that was supposed to free up the banks to behave normally again, and it would free up the frozen credit market. It turns out that that never even happened. He finally changed his mind. He looked at what was going on in England and other parts of the world and decided, you know, we're not going to buy these troubled assets, which nobody knows how to value anyway. We're just going to funnel the money to the banks, essentially nationalizing to some extent.
Yeah.
But the program was badly conceived. There was very little oversight. No one is really clear what happened to the first half of that money.
Oh, my God. $350 billion down the tubes.
$350 billion. And now we don't know if it's down the tubes, because you can't make the assumption that all the banks misused the money. But they did not use the money to free up the credit markets to any tremendous extent, which was supposed to be the idea. In any event, the public is very upset about the way this money was spent without oversight. And now Obama is coming, and he wants the other $350 billion, and he says he's going to use some of that money to help people who are having trouble, you know, they're in danger of their homes being foreclosed and that sort of thing. So the money wouldn't be going off to the bank. Well, now there's a fight over that money and whether the Congress really wants to allow the president to spend this other $350 billion. But the essential issue is this. You've got $700 billion of these so-called TARP funds, however it's spent. You've got the deficits that you were talking about. You've got the $800 billion stimulus plan that Obama has proposed, and which will probably be approved by the Congress. And that's going to jack the debt up, the deficits up enormously. We're already at an annual deficit of $1.2 trillion, and that's going to increase. So what is going to happen is, a year or two from now, whatever is going on with the economy, you're going to get the more conservative elements in the Congress to step up and say, hold on a minute. We cannot continue to spend all this money. Look at these mounting deficits. What goes on here? And, of course, they're going to be opposed to raising taxes, because they're always opposed to raising taxes. So there's not going to be any remnants there. So what are they going to do? They're going to say, these things that you're saying, you liberals are saying, we need to help ordinary people, we can't afford it. We're not going to be able to have health care. We're not going to be able to improve the public schools. We're not going to be able to provide a reasonable safety net, even though we know that we're in very terrible economic hard times. And they're just going to cut it off. I am really positive that in another year, 18 months or 2 years, that's what's going to happen. They're going to say, we can't spend any more money.
That's terrifying, Bob, when you think that 47 million people in America have no health insurance. Now, I come from a country in Australia. I've spent a lot of time in America, and I practice medicine at Harvard, so I know both systems quite intimately. Mm-hmm. But here we have nationalized medicine. Mm-hmm. We go to the doctor, we pay the bill, we go next door, and the government gives us the cash in hand, and it comes from our taxes. And somehow that's been made to seem sort of semi-evil in America, that's socialism and maybe communism.
And it's really weird, and I'll tell you the reason it's especially weird is because we have two forms of socialized medicine in the United States that's working extremely well.
Yeah.
One is Medicare.
Yep.
Which is, for older Americans.
Yes.
Yeah. And it works wonderfully. I love that story where there was a woman who was a voter who was talking to a Republican, a Republican who was running for a seat in Congress, and she was he was talking about socialism, this and that, and then too much big government, and she was saying, and another thing, you tell the government to keep its hands off my Medicare. She loves it. She loves Medicare so much and has no conception that this is a government program, socialized medicine. So that's one example where it works extremely well in the United States. The other example is in the military. I mean, you get medical coverage for every... I was in the Army back in the 60s. You get medical coverage for everyone who was in the military, and it works extremely well. This is health coverage, health care provided by the government. You know, the idea that you have these obscene profits being made by corporations and others in the health industry, while at the same time that you have 48, 49, 50 million Americans without any coverage at all and climbing, and a lot of people underinsured above that, is a disgrace, absolute disgrace.
Well, obviously, the whole thing needs to be changed. I think insurance companies have to get the hell out of medicine. I think that, I mean, Congress and the president have the power to change this. The drug companies are obscene. The drug companies.
I think the insurance companies should be out of medicine, but that's not going to happen.
But it's not an medicine, Bob. It's not an industry. I took the Hippocratic Oath when I was 18 in medical school. Medicine is not an industry. It's a profession that serves the people. And even if we don't get paid, we're at least helping people get better or helping them to die in a dignified fashion.
Yeah, but the point is, it is an industry in the United States.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be. But that's the reason why you can't get health coverage to all Americans.
I know.
So many people are making so much money off of it, and they're unwilling to relinquish that.
No, but who's going to have the guts to take on this really wicked industry? And I say that advisedly. Both the drug companies. Look, I went into a CVS pharmacy in Washington recently and I wanted to buy, I don't know, about 15 sleeping pills for my jet lag. And I think I wrote out the script or someone did. And the man said, that'll be $93. And I said in a really loud voice, I'd rather stay awake all night than pay $93. And I marched out of the shop and he said, well, you're lucky. You're a doctor. You got it cheaply. And I have never, I mean... Here it would cost me $2.50. I mean, how dare they charge? And that's the drug companies.
There are people in the United States right now, even as we're talking, who are foregoing their medicine because they can't afford it, because they have to spend the money on food for their family.
And they'll die. I mean,
that's what I mean. I'm talking about people with extremely serious illnesses.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about mild stuff. It's terrible. But, you're talking about getting the insurance industry out of health care.
Yeah.
That's not even the plan. I mean, when Obama and Hillary were running, I mean, the idea is to compel people to buy insurance.
Yeah.
That's how you get universal coverage.
Don't they understand?
The idea is not to get insurance out of the picture entirely.
Well, Hillary screwed it up anyway when she was, given the mandate virtually with Bill's election to nationalize medicine. And what did she do? She worked in the West Wing and brought in all the insurance companies. Of course it was bound to fail. But I just have to tell you, I treated cystic fibrosis patients, and I was at Harvard, and The parents could not afford antibiotics for their dying children. And this was in the 70s. And I can't tell you how I felt. And then I sat next to a man in a plane once. And he said, I'm not going to pay my taxes for health care for you. And I nearly vomited in his lap. I mean, I'd never heard anything so
selfish and
cruel.
Yeah.
And the other thing
we have made, and I don't really know how this happened, but in this country, we have made people who are poor or people who are sick or people who lose their jobs, we have made them out to be villains, as though they had done something wrong, deserve their fate, and why should the rest of the country rally around and take care of them? It's as though there are some kind of charity case or something.
You know, and most
Americans, it's a very sick approach.
Yeah, I know most Americans go to church and they believe they're Christians. But you know, what about the Good Samaritan? And you know, what about what Jesus said and preached? I mean, you can't call yourself a Christian unless you walk in the footsteps of that man, who I think was a great psychiatrist, you know, just to start with. But the other thing I want to point out too is, why should employers pay the insurance for the employees? That's not fair. That's a huge burden on employers. It should come out of the government instead of spending $1 trillion on killing people in the Pentagon. It's all so terribly obvious to me, Bob, and I don't know what, it's so frustrating because the country could be really helped by a fine, fine president who had that sort of vision, do you think?
You know, I think so, but I don't think that we're there. And I think that, you know, you can't expect that. I'll put it this way. I don't expect that from Obama. I do not expect the United States to really ratchet down the amount of money that it spends on the Pentagon.
Don't you really?
I definitely don't think that that's going to happen. I don't think that we're going to get the insurance companies out of health care. I don't think for a moment that's going to happen. I think the best you can expect here is some incremental expansion of health coverage. You know, for example, expanding the program that covers children, health insurance for children. They call it the CHIP program here.
Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps some expansions of Medicare and that sort of thing. I don't think that we're going to get socialized medicine in the United States anytime soon, although, of course, I think we should have it. So I think that we're in trouble.
Mm.
You know, I think we're in an emergency economic situation right now, but I think going ahead, it'll be a case of, you know, putting up your arm and trying to fend off catastrophe, and I think that's the best you can expect for the foreseeable future.
It feels a little bit like the Roman Empire.
It feels very much like the Roman Empire, which is very frightening to me. It's as though, as we were talking about Afghanistan a little while ago, it's as though we do not learn our lessons from history. You know, we'll see. You know, one of the reasons, you know, if they can get this consumer economy back on some even slightly reasonable track.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the big problem there is that the consumer economy was powered by indebtedness.
Yeah.
You know, it's an enormous consumer market. So you still have these countries overseas who want to tap into that American market. So, you know, it's sort of a house of cards kind of thing, but they're trying to keep the house of cards upright.
Yes, and then, you know, if you look at the world resources and environmentally what's happening, this is a finite planet with finite resources. And the truth is we cannot keep growing and buying and selling stuff because we're going to run out.
Well, one of the problems here, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but I can certainly speak for the United States, is that we never look past the day after tomorrow. Mm. You know, it's almost like the future doesn't exist. We don't plan for the future. It's a very immature approach to existence. It's like, you know, what's happening today and maybe what's happening tomorrow, but certainly not what we need to do to have a sustainable future beyond the day after tomorrow.
Which
is really quite troubling.
It is, because, but that's another reason I'm glad that Obama got elected because he has put Carol Browner back, and he's got some very good environmentalists in his programs now. Goodness knows where that will lead, but I think he's got some quite forward thinkers.
I think that he does too. The thing that I'm worried about is that the economy at the moment tends to trump everything else. That's the thing that bothers me. He's got an interesting mix in the cabinet, which is why it's so difficult to answer some questions, because we don't know the direction this administration is going to take.
Mm.
Is he going to listen to the more progressive voices in his cabinet, which would be terrific? Hilda Solis, for example, is a labor secretary. She's very progressive when it comes to the rights of workers and stopping these attacks on union organizing and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So is Obama going to listen to her, or is he going to have a more conservative approach coming perhaps from a Larry Summers or this fella Geithner, who had been the head of the New York Fed? So it'll be very interesting to see who he listens to. Is he going to listen to perhaps a more hawkish opinion from Hillary Clinton, or maybe there's some more dovish voices inside the cabinet? You know, it's going to be fascinating to see the direction in which he moves. What I would hope is that he's not like Bill Clinton in the sense of this kind of triangulation strategy, you know, a bit of a step to the left and then a step to the right, you know, and we'll slice it in half and, you know, here we are. I worry about that.
I do too, except that I really remember what he said when people were worried about some of his appointees, and he said, "I'm the one who makes the decisions." It sounds a bit like George Bush, "I'm the decider."
I'm the decider.
But, right. You know, I think, but I don't know, I'm postulating, that he has the strength of character, I think. And when you look at his diplomatic skills in the past and how he's really focused on getting to where he is at the moment, I have a sense that he's going to use all these quite brilliant people he's appointed judiciously, tap their brains and give them their marching orders. Let's see where it goes. But I'm going to stay up all night and watch the inauguration, and I know I'm going to be in floods of tears.
I hope that you're right. I do think that he has appointed really talented, smart people to the cabinet. That is a welcome change from the Bush administration, where there were a bunch of clowns and ideologues and incompetents running the country. So that's a big step forward right there.
I loved your piece. Just to finish, Bob, I'm interviewing Bob Herbert from the New York Times about George Bush. And I meant to print it out, but I don't think it came out of my printer, but how you think that Bush shouldn't go off scot-free and leave after making such a hell of a mess of absolutely everything. What would you, if you were Obama, what would you do? What would you do?
I have mixed feelings there.
Yeah.
Because the country is in such a difficult situation right now, I don't think that it would be helpful to go after the Bush-Cheney crowd in terms of prosecutions, unless there were some clear criminal instances that just cried out for prosecutions. But if you were starting to talk about the war crimes and and the torture and all that sort of thing, which is evil. I mean, I would never condone it. I spent years ranting against it in the column and that sort of thing. But I do think that if the Obama administration went after them on that stuff, it would tear the country apart, and we would not be able to. It would consume the country, and we would not be able to address these very serious problems we have now. But what I do think is that I think that the media, and I think that the public, and I think that the various organizations, civic and otherwise, in this country, there should be an outcry over what this guy and his administration have done to the country and to other parts of the world.
Yes.
I think they have been just profoundly destructive.
Yes.
They have done things that I think were just absolutely awful and unforgivable. And I think that that should be part of the public conversation. I think there should be a lot more anger, a lot more outrage in the national conversation in the United States.
Yeah, and you did suggest setting up some or one commission anyway to investigate it in a civilized fashion.
Oh, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I'm a firm believer in bringing everything to the fore.
Yeah.
I do think that this stuff should be investigated. You've got congressional committees who can do it on their own. Absolutely, wherever you think that there was some wrongdoing or just something that needs to be brought to the public's attention, mm-hmm. brought to light, I'm in favor of that.
And then it becomes part of the history.
Exactly right.
Well,
and, of course, if in the course of that you come across things that just cries out for prosecution, then you have to go forward with it.
Yeah.
You know, but
I'm sure Cheney would be one of the first people.
I'd be very surprised, though, if
he's clever.
If this country went after Bush or Cheney,
yeah.
And I do think that if that occurred, the country would be convulsed. I mean, if you go back to Gerry Ford when he pardoned Richard Nixon, I'm a believer. I certainly was no fan of Richard Nixon. I'm a believer that probably was the right move. Watergate had gone on and convulsed the country for the longest period of time.
Yeah.
And that they had then gone on and gone after Nixon to prosecute him after he was out of office.
Yeah.
I don't know when we would have gotten back on track.
No, and he got his comeuppance in the end.
He did. And that's another case of where sort of the public view of that guy and the historic view of Nixon was the correct view.
Yeah. Well, it will be for Bush too. Look, I really thank you enormously, Bob Herbert, for this interview, which has been absolutely fascinating, as usual. Maybe we'll come back to you in a year's time and get your take on where we are at that time.
That'd be fantastic, and it's wonderful talking to you.
Yeah.
And I hope you know, our paths will cross again one of these days in New York. I don't know if I'll get down there, but perhaps, you know, maybe we'll see.
Well, I'll be there in April. Maybe we can, as they say, do lunch.
Whenever you're here, I can give you a luncheon invitation on the radio. Just give me a holler and we'll go out and we'll swap stories and have a bite.
Excellent, Bob. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have just been interviewing Bob Herbert, a twice-weekly journalist for the New York Times, presenting his prescient observations of past political activities in the United States and future activities as the new Obama administration is inaugurated. Thank you so much for listening this time to If You Love This Planet. Don't forget, if you'd like to support us, you can go to the webpage ifyoulovethisplanet.org. And there is a place where you can make donations, which would be very gratefully accepted. My producer today was Jasmine Williams, and we will talk to you again next week. Thank you and goodbye.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.